A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And honestly, it's a question that's been hanging over a lot of conversations I've had recently. We've done episodes on the ghost towers, the light rail chaos, the secular flight from the city. But the prompt today is, what does Jerusalem actually have going for it? What natural advantages does it hold over other Israeli cities that could, with the right policy choices, turn it from the poorest large city in the country into something that actually feels like a thriving hub for the Jewish people? Not supplanting Tel Aviv as the economic engine, but not being defined by a 46% poverty rate and net negative migration either.
That not supplanting Tel Aviv framing is important because I think one of the traps Jerusalem keeps falling into is trying to compete on Tel Aviv's terms. The question isn't, how does Jerusalem become the next startup capital? The question is, what Jerusalem has that Tel Aviv, Haifa, Beersheba simply don't, and whether those assets are being left on the table.
That's the problem in a nutshell. But today we're not going to dwell on what's broken. We're going to ask what Jerusalem has going for it that nobody's talking about.
And the first thing to say is that the data on the problems is not ambiguous. The Central Bureau of Statistics put out its Quality of Life report for 2024, 46% of Jerusalem families living below the poverty line. The Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research tracked net secular outmigration at roughly 10,000 people per year from 2020 to 2025. Those are structural numbers, not a blip. And yet, at the same time, this is the city that houses the Knesset, the Supreme Court, the Bank of Israel, the Hebrew University, Yad Vashem, the Israel Museum, and the holiest sites in Judaism. That gap between institutional wealth and lived poverty, that's the puzzle.
It's not just a puzzle. It's a paradox that should make anyone stop and ask, why hasn't institutional gravity produced economic gravity? Most capital cities get a built-in advantage from hosting the government, has a stable middle class anchored by federal employment. London, Paris, Berlin. The government presence creates a floor. Jerusalem has the government, the courts, the central bank, and it's the poorest city in the country.
That's where I want to start, because this is the most counterintuitive of Jerusalem's natural advantages, and the one that's been most thoroughly squandered. Let's go through four structural assets the city has, assess which are real and which are overrated, and then talk about the specific policy levers that could convert them into actual economic opportunity. First, institutional density. Second, demographic complementarity. Third, tourism as a year-round industry. Fourth, what I'd call the capital city premium for research and high tech. Each of these has something underneath it that the standard conversation misses.
Let's start with the most obvious advantage that somehow hasn't delivered. The fact that Jerusalem is the seat of government, the home of the Supreme Court, and the center of Israeli cultural institutions. Why hasn't that made the city rich?
Here's the mechanism that most people don't see. Jerusalem hosts the Knesset. All government ministries, the Supreme Court, the Bank of Israel headquarters, the Hebrew University, which is ranked in the top 100 globally, plus the Israel Museum, Yad Vashem, and dozens of NGOs and policy think tanks. No other Israeli city has this concentration of what economists call non-market employers. These are institutions whose funding comes from national budgets, endowments, and international grants, not from the local economy. In theory, they should create a stable employment base that anchors the city. In practice, they're what the urban policy literature calls cathedrals in the desert. The people who work in these institutions largely don't live in Jerusalem. They commute in from Modi'in, from Mevaseret Zion, from the settlements west of the city. They earn their salaries, they spend those salaries in the suburbs where they live, and they contribute almost nothing to Jerusalem's municipal tax base or its retail ecosystem. The government ministries alone employ something like 30,000 people. If even a third of them lived within the city limits, you'd have an overnight middle-class tax base.
It's not that the institutions don't create wealth. It's that the wealth leaks out of the city every evening at 5 o'clock.
and this isn't an unsolvable problem, has had various forms of residency requirements for federal employees going back to the Hatch Act era. The idea is straightforward. If you draw a salary funded by national taxpayers, and your workplace is in the capital city, there's a public interest in you contributing to that city's tax base and civic life. Jerusalem could implement something similar. Require a percentage of senior civil servants, say deputy director general level and above, to reside within the municipal boundaries.
There was actually a NESIC committee discussion about this in 2025, wasn't there?
The Interior Committee took it up, and it was shelved almost immediately. The Hardy parties didn't want residency requirements that might affect their constituents who work in government but live in Hardy. Only neighborhoods outside the city. The National Religious Party was split, and the secular parties didn't push hard because, frankly, many of their voters are the ones commuting from Modi'in and prefer it that way. So the structural fix is simple. The politics are terrible.
That's what makes it worth talking about. If the problem is political will, not feasibility, then it's a choice, not a fate. What's the counterargument from the people who oppose this?
The main counterargument is that Jerusalem doesn't have the housing stock to absorb thousands of additional middle-class families, and that forcing people to live in the city would just drive them out of government service entirely. There's some truth to the housing point. The luxury tower boom has produced thousands of empty units, but they're priced for foreign investors, not for civil servants. A residency requirement would need to be paired with a serious, affordable housing push. But the people will quit argument? I'm skeptical. Government jobs in Israel come with tenure, pensions, and benefits that are hard to walk away from. Most people would relocate rather than resign.
Institutional density is a sleeping asset. It needs policy to wake it up. But there are two other advantages that are more organic and maybe easier to leverage. Let's talk about the demographic picture, because that's usually framed as Jerusalem's biggest weakness.
Right, and this is where I think the standard narrative gets it almost entirely wrong. Jerusalem is roughly 40% Haredi, 30% secular or traditional Jewish, 20% Arab, and 10% national religious. The usual framing is fragmentation, political gridlock, communities that don't interact, a city that can't cohere around a shared economic agenda. And there's truth to that. The 2024 municipal elections had 38% voter turnout, the lowest in 20 years. People are checked out.
You're going to tell me there's an upside buried in that demographic breakdown.
I'm going to tell you that demographically, Jerusalem has the most diverse labor force in the country, and that's a massive asset if the education and training infrastructure can actually produce workers with relevant skills. Look at the components. The Haredi population is young and growing, median age around 18, which means a huge pool of potential workers entering the labor market every year. The secular and traditional population is educated and professional. The Arab population has deep commercial networks in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and Arabic language skills that are valuable for everything from international trade to intelligence-adjacent tech work. No other Israeli city has this range.
The Haredi employment piece is the one that gets the most attention, because it's the biggest variable. If Haredi men stay in yeshiva and don't enter the workforce, you've got a permanently poor, rapidly growing segment of the population. If they enter the workforce, everything changes.
Something real is happening on that front. The 2023 and 2024 budget cuts to yeshiva stipends changed the economic calculation for a lot of families. But more important, in my view, is the expansion of Haredi vocational training programs. The KAMA initiative, KAMA, spelled Kaf Mem Aleph, launched in 2023 specifically to place Haredi men in tech jobs. By the fourth quarter of 2025, it had placed 1,200 men in software development and cybersecurity roles.
1,200 is a pilot number. That's not transforming the city's economy yet.
No, but the retention rate is what makes it interesting. 82% were still in those jobs 12 months later. That's extremely high for any workforce development program, let alone one targeting a population with limited secular education. The KAMA program works by partnering directly with tech companies. They co-design the curriculum with the employers, so graduates have job offers waiting. And the companies have found that Haredi workers, once trained, have lower turnover and higher productivity in certain roles than the general population. There's a cultural fit piece that nobody predicted.
lower turnover because they're not job-hopping to the next startup with a higher salary.
Also, the Haredi community places a high value on stability and loyalty to an employer. In an industry where churn is a huge cost, that's a real advantage. If this model scales, if Kama places 5,000 or 10,000 workers instead of 1,200, you start to see a Jerusalem where the Haredi sector isn't a poverty story, it's a competitive advantage. You've got a labor pool that's young, growing, and increasingly skilled in a country where the secular workforce is aging and the high-tech sector is desperate for talent.
The flip side of that, though, is that if the secular flight continues, you lose the population that currently anchors the professional class. The Haredi workforce integration is a medium-term play. In the short term, Jerusalem is still bleeding the people who fill its universities, its hospitals, its law firms.
Which is why the residency requirement and the Haredi workforce integration have to happen in parallel. The residency piece stabilizes the secular middle class. The workforce piece creates economic mobility for the Haredi population. You can't do one without the other and expect the city's trajectory to change.
Let's move to the third advantage. Tourism. And I want to push back on this one a bit, because tourism is often held up as the great hope for struggling cities, and it almost never delivers what people promise.
And the standard critique is that tourism produces low-wage service jobs, hotel cleaners, restaurant workers, tour bus drivers that don't build a middle class. That critique is correct if you're talking about the model Jerusalem has historically pursued. Chain hotels, day trippers, group tours that stop at the Western Wall and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and then get back on the bus to the Dead Sea. That model generates revenue for the hotel chains and the bus companies, but very little for the local economy.
You're going to tell me there's a different tourism model that actually circulates money locally.
There's data on this, and it's striking. Jerusalem had 4.5 million overnight visitors in 2025, according to the Ministry of Tourism. That's a huge number. But the economic leakage is enormous because of the hotel dependence model. A 2024 municipal study found something that should reshape how the city thinks about tourism. Airbnb guests in Jerusalem spend 3.2 times more in local businesses than hotel guests.
3.2 times? That's not marginal.
It's not marginal at all. The mechanism is straightforward. Hotel guests eat breakfast at the hotel buffet, dinner at the hotel restaurant, and their itinerary is often packaged by the tour operator. Airbnb guests wake up in an apartment in the German colony or Nachlaut. They walk to a local cafe for breakfast. They shop at Mahane Yehuda for lunch ingredients. They use local services. The money circulates. The city currently has about 2,800 Airbnb units, mostly concentrated in the city center and the German colony. The policy question is whether the city should be actively encouraging this kind of short-term rental in designated zones, rather than treating it as a problem to be regulated away.
There's a tension there, though, because short-term rentals in residential neighborhoods also reduce the housing supply for actual residents. Barcelona, Amsterdam, New York, they've all cracked down on Airbnb specifically because it was hollowing out neighborhoods.
That's why the zoning piece matters. The proposal isn't let Airbnb run wild everywhere. It's to designate specific corridors, the city center, areas near the light rail, neighborhoods that already have a mix of commercial and residential use, and actively encourage short-term rentals there while restricting them in purely residential areas like Ramat or Pisgat Ze'ev. The 2024 municipal study suggested that a targeted approach could increase local business revenue from tourism by an estimated 400 million shekels annually without meaningful impact on the long-term rental market.
The other piece of the tourism puzzle that doesn't get enough attention is the seasonal pattern. Tel Aviv's tourism is beach-driven and peaks in summer. Jerusalem's tourism is pilgrimage-driven and is actually strongest in spring and fall, Passover, Easter, Sukkot. That means the city has a more even distribution of visitors across the year, which makes tourism-related employment less seasonal and more stable. That's a genuine structural advantage.
It connects to what I think is the biggest underexploited opportunity, the extended stay and experience economy. The Masa Israel program brought 11,000 young diaspora Jews to Jerusalem for semester-length stays in 2025. Average stay was 4 months. Average spending was $4,200 per participant in local businesses. A 2023 study by the Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research estimated that each MASA participant generates $1,800 in local tax revenue. Now imagine scaling that. Not just MASA, but culinary tourism programs, artisan workshops in the Old City, guided walking tours that go deeper than the standard holy sites itinerary. The city has the historical and cultural depth to support a high-value tourism economy. It just hasn't built the infrastructure for it.
The shift is from come to Jerusalem for 2 days, see the sights, eat at the hotel, leave, to come to Jerusalem for 2 weeks, live in a neighborhood, learn something, spend money locally.
That's the shift. And it doesn't require building anything new. It requires regulatory changes around short-term rentals, investment in tourism workforce training, and a municipal marketing strategy that targets extended stay visitors rather than bus tours. The assets already exist. The policy framework doesn't.
Institutional density is a sleeping asset. Demographic diversity is a potential labor market advantage. And tourism is an under-optimized industry. What about the fourth one? The high-tech and research piece. Because that's the one where Jerusalem seems most obviously outmatched by Tel Aviv.
Yet, there's more happening in Jerusalem's research ecosystem than most people realize. The Hebrew University's Computer Science Department is ranked number one in Israel for AI research. Intel has a major development center on the Givat Ram campus, 1,200 employees. The Bio-Jerusalem cluster around Hadassah Medical Center in Ein Kerem has grown to 82 life sciences companies as of 2025. That cluster attracted $340 million in venture capital in 2025, up from $210 million in 2022. The city's high-tech sector grew at 8% annually from 2020 to 2025, compared to 6% nationally.
The growth is real. What's stopping it from being bigger?
First, commercial real estate. Jerusalem simply doesn't have the kind of affordable, flexible office and lab space that early-stage companies need. A startup that wants 300 square meters of open-plan office near other startups has almost nowhere to go. The real estate market is dominated by residential, much of it luxury, and the commercial space that exists is fragmented and overpriced. Second, there's no downtown tech hub. Tel Aviv has Rothschild Boulevard and the surrounding area where founders, engineers, and investors run into each other constantly. Jerusalem has nothing comparable. The talent and the research output are there. The networking infrastructure and the physical space aren't.
This is where the Innovation District proposal comes in.
The Jerusalem Development Authority proposed this in 2024. 50,000 square meters of mixed-use office, lab, and residential space on 12 dunams of underutilized government-owned land near the central bus station, with its own light rail stop. The idea is to create a concentrated hub where startups, research labs, and venture capital firms can co-locate, with residential units so people can actually live near where they work. The JDA estimates it would create 8,000 high-tech jobs within the city limits by 2030.
At what cost?
1.2 billion shekels to build. The projected economic activity over 10 years is estimated at 2.5 billion shekels. So you're looking at roughly a 2-to-1 return over a decade, not counting the multiplier effects of having 8,000 high-salary workers spending money in the local economy. The Ministry of Finance has the proposal. It's stalled over budget disputes between the municipality and the national government.
Once again, the bottleneck is political, not technical.
Every single advantage we've discussed has the same shape. The asset is real. The mechanism for converting it into economic opportunity is understood. The obstacle is a political system that can't align around a shared development agenda. The 2024 municipal elections had 38% turnout. That's not a mandate for anything. The city council is fragmented across Haredi, secular, national religious, and Arab factions that rarely agree on anything beyond basic municipal services.
Which brings us to the question of what can actually be done in the next 5 years. Let's pull the threads together.
We've got four natural advantages: institutional density, demographic diversity, year-round tourism, and a growing research ecosystem. The question is, what are the highest leverage moves?
I put the residency requirement at the top of the list. It's the single policy change that would most directly address the net migration problem. You create a stable middle class that lives, spends, and pays taxes in the city. It's politically difficult, but structurally simple. No new buildings required. No new programs to design. Just a rule change.
The second is the Innovation District. It's the most concrete near-term project for diversifying the economy away from government and tourism. 8,000 high-tech jobs changes the city's economic profile. It creates a constituency of young professionals who have a stake in the city's future, and it builds on an existing strength, the research output of the Hebrew University and the Hadassah Medical Cluster, rather than trying to invent something from scratch. Listeners who are Jerusalem residents or stakeholders can actually advocate for this. The Jerusalem Development Authority has a public comment process. Their contact is info@jday.gov.il.
Third, the tourism pivot. Stop chasing chain hotels and start building the infrastructure for extended stay, experience-based tourism. The data is clear. Short-term rental guests spend 3 times more in local businesses. The MASA program shows that extended stays generate real tax revenue. This doesn't require a billion shekel investment. It requires zoning changes and a shift in the municipal marketing strategy.
Underneath all of these is the workforce development piece, the KAMA program, and its successors. If the hardy employment trend continues and accelerates, Jerusalem gains a labor market advantage that no other Israeli city can replicate. Young, growing, increasingly skilled workforce in a country where talent is the binding constraint on economic growth. That's a 20-year play, but the trajectory is set by decisions made now.
Those are the levers. But there's a deeper question that hangs over all of this, and it's the one nobody in City Hall wants to answer. Can Jerusalem's political fragmentation ever align around an economic development agenda? The 2024 elections were a disaster for civic legitimacy. 38% turnout says that most Jerusalemites have given up on the idea that the municipality can improve their lives. But then, in 2025, the budget negotiations produced a rare cross-sector agreement on funding for vocational training. Haredi, secular, and Arab representatives all signed on. Is that a one-off, or is it the start of a new pattern?
I think it's too early to call it a pattern, but it's not nothing. The vocational training agreement happened because each sector saw something in it for themselves. The Haredi parties wanted funding for yeshiva to employment pipelines. The secular parties wanted workforce development for young professionals. The Arab parties wanted Arabic language vocational programs. It was a log roll, but it was a productive log roll. If that model could be replicated, if each sector can see economic development as serving its own interests rather than someone else's, you start to have the political conditions for change.
The counterpoint, though, is that the residency requirement was shelved by that same coalition in the same year. So the cross-sector cooperation extends to programs that distribute new money, but not to policies that impose costs on anyone's constituency.
That's a fair distinction. And it's why the Innovation District is such an important test case. It's a new money project. It doesn't take anything away from anyone. If the political system can't even agree to build something that creates 8,000 jobs with a 2-to-1 return on investment, then the pessimists are right, and Jerusalem's structural advantages will remain permanently unrealized. If it can, then there's a template for moving from zero-sum politics to positive-sum economic development.
There's a broader implication here that I think is worth naming. Jerusalem is not the only capital city that struggles with this paradox. Had decades of the same dynamic, the federal government has a cathedral in the desert, surrounded by poverty and disinvestment. Brasilia has it. Canberra has it. Capital cities that are built around government and institutions often struggle to develop diverse, self-sustaining local economies. If Jerusalem can crack the code on converting institutional density into local economic vitality, it becomes a model that other cities watch.
The tools are increasingly available. The JNet light rail expansion, which, for all the construction pain, is nearing completion, creates the transit backbone that makes the Innovation District viable and connects residential neighborhoods to employment centers. The Haredi workforce integration is happening organically, driven by economic necessity and the success of programs like KAMA. The tourism data is there, waiting for a municipal government willing to act on it. None of this requires Jerusalem to become Tel Aviv. It requires Jerusalem to become a better version of what it already is.
The prompt asked about natural advantages. What Jerusalem has that other cities don't? And the answer, I think, is that Jerusalem's advantages are genuine but latent. Institutional density that leaks wealth instead of capturing it. Demographic diversity that's treated as a liability instead of an asset. A tourism industry optimized for the wrong kind of visitor. A research ecosystem that produces world-class work, but can't retain the companies that commercialize it. In every case, the raw material is there. What's missing is the policy framework to convert raw material into economic opportunity.
The 5-year window matters. The secular flight numbers, 10,000 net out migration per year, are not sustainable indefinitely. At some point, the city crosses a threshold where the professional class is too small to anchor the institutions and the tax base. The JNet completion and the post-construction recovery create a moment where the city is more accessible and livable than it's been in years. If the structural advantages can't be leveraged now, the negative trends become permanent.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, a mathematician on the island of Mauritius developed a numerical notation system in which numbers were sung rather than written. Each digit corresponded to a specific pitch and duration, turning arithmetic into a form of four-part harmony. The system was used primarily for calculating maritime trade ledgers and reportedly made errors immediately audible as dissonance.
Accounting is choral music. That's one way to catch embezzlement.
I have so many questions about the rehearsals. Tenor section, you're flat on the 7.
On that note, if you want to dig deeper into the data behind today's episode, we've posted the CBS Quality of Life Report, the JDA Innovation District Proposal, and the Comma Program Impact Assessment at myweirdprompts.com/201. And if you have a weird prompt you want us to tackle, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.